This is Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue on KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham. Streaming live at mybellinghamnow.com.
Okay, welcome to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning here live in the studio. As usual, we're going to start out with our weekly wrap-up. And the stock market exhibited some rebound action after a soft start to the month. It was a busy week, featuring earnings results from nearly 40% of the S&P 500 and some key economic releases. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.7% for the week, the S&P 500 gained 2.7%, and the NASDAQ Composite settled 4.2% higher this week. The upside bias was fueled by favorable responses to earnings from some influential names, calm prices actions in treasuries, and carryover momentum as gains build up as this week went on. Broad buying activity left the equal-weighted S&P 500 up 1.6% this week, and all 11 S&P 500 sectors finished higher. Mega cap gains were outsized impact on index performance, though, and drove gains in the information technology sector, which were up 5.1%, consumer discretionary up 3.5%, and communication services up 2.7%. Meta Platforms was an exception from the mega cap space, dropping 7.9% this week after reporting earnings. Microsoft, Alphabet, which hit a new high all-time high, and Tesla gained 1.8%, 11.5%, and 14.4% respectively in response to their earnings news. The quarterly reports from some of the aforementioned names fueled positive buzz around AI, benefiting stocks in the chipmaker space. The semiconductor index jumped 10% this week. Market participants were also digesting the advanced first quarter GDP report, which showed weaker growth and higher inflation, and weekly jobless claims reports, which showed ongoing strength in the labor market, and the March personal income and spending report, which showed solid spending activity but stalled progress on inflation. Treasuries had a relatively calm response to the data, contributing to the upside bias in stocks. The 10-year note yield was 5 basis points at 4.67%. 2-year note yield rose 3 basis points to 5%. So looking at Monday's market, we saw the stock market exhibited rebound action on Monday following last week's solid declines. The market remained resilient when the early buying activity dissipated, which became its own upside catalyst in the afternoon trade. Ultimately, the major indices settled off session highs, leaving the S&P 500 back above the 5,000 level. Afternoon buying in the stock market was supported by some short covering activity, along with turnaround action in some heavily weighted names. The Tesla was left out of the everything rally, although on Monday, following another round of EV price cuts, many other stocks finished higher, though. Bank stocks outperformed the broader market and boosted the financial sector amid ongoing earnings news from that industry. There was no notable U.S. economic data onto Monday's calendar. But on Tuesday, the market started on a higher note and never really looked back, enjoying a session that saw very little selling interest at the index level. The major indices closed near their best levels of the day. Tuesday's positive turn was driven by favorable responses by earnings results, lower market rates, and broad-based buying interest that featured outperformance of the small caps and mega cap stocks. The price action in treasuries facilitated some added rebound action in the growth stocks, which, while placating a market angling to follow through on Monday's rebound effort. Good earnings results out of the industrial sector as well as the consumer discretionary sector provided an added angle for follow-through from buying interest. Reviewing Tuesday's economic data, we saw the preliminary S&P Global U.S. Manufacturing PMI for April dropped to 49.9 from 51.9 in March, while the preliminary S&P U.S. Global Services PMI fell to 50.9 from 51.7 in March. New home sales increased 8.8% month over month in March to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 693,000 units. On a year-over-year basis, new home sales are up 8.3%. The key takeaway from this report is that new home sales were up in every region, helping in part by another dip in the median sales price. Although average prices were up with a pickup in sales of higher-priced homes, particularly in the West region. On Wednesday, the stock market exhibited mixed action. The market indices traded above and below their prior closing levels, and market breadth was mostly negative through the session. Decliners had a 3-2 lead on the New York Stock Exchange and a 4-3 lead on the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 nearly unchanged, and the NASDAQ gained 0.1%. An early drive higher was fueled by positive response to some earnings news like Tesla, which jumped 12% following the acknowledgement that the production of affordable models is going to begin in early 2025, if not later this year, despite missing earnings and revenue estimates. And Texas Instruments was another standout winner after suggesting that some industrial customers are nearing the end of an inventory correction cycle. This price action contributed to upside moves in the semiconductor index, which closed 1.1% higher. Meanwhile, Boeing, poor old Boeing, and Humana received negative responses to their quarterly results. Reviewing Wednesday's economic data, the weekly MBA mortgage index was down 2.7%. March durable orders were up 2.6. Prior was revised to 0.7 from 1.4, and March durable goods, if you took out transportation, was also up 0.2%. The key takeaway from this report is it matched the framework of a soft landing for the economy, with non-defense capital goods orders, excluding aircraft, a proxy for business spending increasing 0.2% on the heels of a 0.4% increase in February. The weekly EIA crude oil inventory showed a draw of 6.37 million barrels following last week's build of 2.74 million barrels. And on Thursday, it was a strong day in the market, but importantly, it wasn't particularly weak day either. Or it wasn't a strong day, but it wasn't weak. The major indices closed with declines, but staged a big recovery off of their lows. The initial move lower at the open was driven by negative responses to earnings news from some widely held names like Meta and Dow Components, IBM, and Caterpillar. There was also some concerns about growth and about the Fed's rate cut path, driving early downside moves. This followed the advanced first quarter GDP report, which showed weaker growth and higher inflation, and weekly jobless claims report, which showed ongoing strength in the labor market. The economic data sent yields higher, contributing to the initial move lower in stocks. Treasuries ultimately settled off their two intraday high level yields, however. This was partially in response to the $44 billion 7-year note sale, which met solid demand. So reviewing Thursday's data, we saw that the March's advance international trade goods were down $91.8 billion. March's advance retail inventories were up 0.3%. The March wholesale inventories were down 0.4%. We also saw weekly jobless claims at 207,000 and continuing claims at 1.781 million. The key takeaway from this report is that it continues to reflect a labor market where employers in general are reluctant to cut jobs, which will be interpreted to mean that they remain generally optimistic about demand. That's not a bad thing unless one is hoping for that rate cut soon. We also saw that the first quarter GDP was up 1.6%. The key takeaway from this report is that it conveyed a disappointing combination of weaker growth and higher inflation. Some will be quick to label that stagflation, but the reality is inflation component isn't the number that Fed is looking for to gain confidence that it can cut rates. We also saw March's pending home sales up 3.4%. A month ago, they were up 1.6%. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up Live. We'll be right back.
Hey, Dave here from Cafe, and I want you to know that whether you're upgrading your laundry room or ready to replace an old dishwasher, you're going to find the best possible deals on appliances at DeWard & Bodie. They are the real appliance pros around here, and they've been selling, servicing, and installing appliances throughout Whatcom and Skagit counties for over 78 years. And right now, it's their final weekend of the annual spring clearance, which means now or never deals on hundreds of floor models and clearance appliances. Now through Monday, they will pay your sales tax on qualifying in-stock appliances or give you up to 2 full years of interest-free financing with no down payment on qualifying purchases. Plus, get fast professional delivery and installation. Also, score huge cashback rebates this weekend, like eligible customers can get up to $425 cash back on qualifying LG laundry sets. It's now or never during DeWard & Bodie's final weekend of spring clearance at all 3 stores in Bellingham and Burlington. See store for details, offer qualifications and restrictions apply.
Join Windermere real estate experts Rick Todd, Julie Brown, and Lyle Sorensen every Saturday at 10 a.m.
You have to treat it more like a balanced market than when we had crazy low interest rates.
Right.
Radio real estate.
Buyers are going to get a great value.
What we like to call real real estate.
Real estate.
Where the buyer actually gets to be represented properly.
Brought to you by Windermere Real Estate on KGMI, AM 790 and 96.5 FM. Streaming live at mybellinghamnow.com. We don't have the usual traffic jams that they have in the big city, but sometimes things happen to snarl everything up. Depend on KGMI to keep you cruising to your destination with KGMI traffic alerts. We'll tell you where the trouble spots are, and if you see problems on the road, give us a call at 360-676-5464 so we can spread the word. KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM, and KGMI.com.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KGMI or the Cascade Radio Group.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning. We're Asset Advisors. We are located out on the Pacific Highway in the Pacific Commerce Center next to Wilson's Furniture. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101, Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number is 360-733-1200. And check out our website at wealthwakeup.com. Okay, continuing on with our weekly wrap-up, we saw the Friday the stock market started the final session of the week on a higher note. It was building on gains through the day. A modest move lower in the late afternoon left the major indices off their highs, which led the had the S&P 500 just shy of the 5,100 level. We saw earnings-related gains in Alphabet, which is Google, which reached a new all-time high, and Microsoft provided a boost to the broader market. Outperforming semiconductor shares, benefiting from the buzz around AI following the aforementioned earnings news, also acted as a boost for the broader market. The semiconductor index jumped 2.6%. Intel was an exception from the semiconductor index, it's sliding nearly 10% after reporting disappointing quarterly results. The energy sector was among the weakest performers, clipping by a loss in ExxonMobil, which after its earnings report, and Chevron was also lower early in the session following its earnings report, but its shares actually settled higher. Market participants were also digesting the March personal income and spending report, which showed solid spending activity but stalled progress on inflation. The market also received the final reading of the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Survey. In April, it came in at 77.2. which showed a weakening from the preliminary reading and an uptick in inflation expectations. So reviewing Friday's economic data, we saw that personal income was 0.5%, and March's personal spending was up 0.8%. March's PCE prices were up 0.3%, and the PCE core prices were also up 0.3%. The key takeaway from this report is the recognition that progress in inflation is stalled. Therefore, market participants should continue to expect the Fed to stall on any rate cut. We also saw the April University of Michigan's consumer sentiment come in at 77.2, The key takeaway from this report is that the consumer sentiment is holding steady despite its uptick in inflation expectations. Presumably, they can be owed to the ongoing strength of the labor market and rising personal income. So up through yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which gained 0.7% this week, is now up 1.5% for the year. The NASDAQ index, however, gained 4.2%, is up 6.1%. The S&P 500 gained 2.7%, is up 6.9%. And the Russell 2000, gained 2.8%, but is still down 1.2% for the year. Okay, well, we like to take a topic every week and focus on it. And this week, we're going to delve into the current state of student loan debt in the United States. That's a subject that has been risen to the forefront of national political discourse. Student loan debt is continuing over 9% of household debt. It stands as the second largest category of consumer debt, trailing only behind mortgages. At the end of fiscal year 23, total outstanding student loan debt reached a staggering $1.73 trillion, with more than 40 million unique loan recipients. This figure underscores the significant financial burden that education financing places on countless Americans due to soaring costs of inflation and tuition. So let's take a look at this scope of this issue. First of all, let's talk about the student loan debt that's outstanding. At the end of fiscal 23, student loan debt in the United States soared to $1.73 trillion. That's a staggering increase of 193% from 2007. This debt falls into two categories, private and federal. Federal loans accounting for 92.8% of the total. Among federal loans, 88.2% are direct loans issued directly by the government. Additionally, there are federal family educational loans, or FFEL, which, although backed by the federal government, are generally held at banks or other private financial institutions. Lastly, there are Perkins loans that cater to students with exceptional financial needs and are subsidized by the federal government. Let's take a look also then at the federal student loan portfolio by borrower debt size. With federal student loans comprising more than 90% of the total student loan debt, analyzing this segment offers a clear insight into the debt landscape for millions of Americans. Currently, there are 41.2 million unique individuals holding federal student loan debt. Of these, 32.8% have balances of $10,000 or less, indicating a substantial number manage relatively small amounts of debt. 41.9% have student loan balances ranging from $10,000 to $40,000. A smaller yet significant portion of 18% hold debt between $40,000 and $100,000, and there's 7.9% of the borrowers find themselves with more than $100,000 in student loan debt. So let's talk about the new seriously delinquent student loan balances that we're seeing. From 2010 to early 20, new serious delinquencies on student loans marked by 90-plus days overdue range from 8 to 11% of total student loans outstanding. But following the CARES Act in March of 2020, which paused payments and set interest rates to zero, delinquencies dropped to about 1% by 21. With payments returning in October of 23 after a three-year pause, delinquencies haven't spiked due to the on-ramp period, allowing borrowers to delay payments for up to another year without penalties. This period, which prevents loans from falling into default or being reported as delinquent, runs until September of 24. Interest continues to accrue, and missed payments will be due post on-ramp, potentially leading to a significant rise in delinquencies in late 24 or early 25. Well, let's see here. I think we're going to go ahead and take a quick break. We'll be back after this news break. Thanks for listening.
Hey, this-
This is Deanna Haraluk with KGMI's all-new Pet Pulse. I'm a pet parent myself, and we all want the best for our critters, whether they're furry, feathered, hooved, or otherwise. The segment is brought to you by Whatcom Veterinary Hospital. Heartworms, fleas, and ticks are more prevalent in the spring and summer. It's recommended to get monthly preventative treatments for your pet. Contact Whatcom Veterinary Hospital for a wellness exam today. And tune in to KGMI's Pet Pulse Wednesdays during the morning news at 6:20 and 7:50, and during the afternoon news at 5:20, right here on KGMI.
You know those friends who say stop by anytime, and you're like, you don't really mean that. Well, unlike those friends, Dewey Griffin Subaru's Express Certified Subaru Tire and Service Center means it. They're open 6 days a week, including Saturdays. Stop by anytime you need an oil change or any other minor maintenance, and they'll take care of you. No appointment necessary, and you'll get a free car wash with your service. Dewey Griffin Subaru. Community-minded, community-driven, and the only Subaru Certified Tire and Service Center in Whatcom County.
Dedicated to service, shining a light on local individuals, law enforcement, and groups giving back to our community. Brought to you by Nieder House of Luxury in Bellingham.
Mackenzie Powell and family turned a negative into a positive when they discovered their new home had housed a seasonal colony of brown bats in the attic. After cleanup, they reached out to Bellingham Makerspace to create an alternate living space when the bats returned this spring. Enter local Girl Scout Amber Nearing, who took on the project of building 40 bat boxes. With a huge assist from Makerspace volunteers Sandy and Mark, the two families, the Bat Conservancy, and our local Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Bat Colony and the Powell family will safely coexist this spring.
Dedicated to service, brought to you by Nieder House of Luxury. Go see why they were recently voted Best Startup Business and Best Jewelry Store in the Northwest. Stop by today to view their beautiful selection of GIA-certified and lab-grown diamonds, plus unique custom designs with an in-house jeweler. Find them at 21 Bellwether Way next to Lombardi's Back Patio.
My name is Sarah, and I just won $1,000.
Sarah's another winner in our Grand in Your Hand contest. What are you going to spend it on, Sarah?
I'm not sure yet. Something special for me, I'd say. Probably a plane ticket.
You could be next. Just listen for our $1,000 keyword each weekday during the 8 a.m., 11 a.m., 2 p.m., and 5 p.m. hours. Enter before midnight at mybellinghamnow.com. It's that easy.
Try at least once a day.
KGMI wants to put a grand in your hand next.
The latest local news and important topics of the day from the West Mechanical Studio.
Harness the power of the sun, reduce your carbon footprint, and save on your energy bills. Explore the advantages of going solar with West Mechanical Heating, Air Conditioning, and Electrical. Find them at westmechanical.net.
Get the latest news and information 24/7 with KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham. Streaming live at mybellinghamnow.com.
CBS News Brief. Tornadoes whipped through multiple states yesterday, causing paths of destruction. CBS's Omar Villafranca has details on one in Nebraska.
Houses shredded in Douglas County, some taking a direct hit by the destructive tornado. A newly built neighborhood with a few homes still under construction, now gone.
Students are rallying on college campuses across the country and even in Paris in support of the Palestinians in Gaza. Many are calling for their administrations to cut ties with organizations they say are aiding the war in Gaza.
We'll support the Palestinian movement at large. We'll support other universities. We'll support all over the globe until Palestine is free.
Former President Trump says he is willing to debate President Biden before the November election.
I just want to say that I've invited Biden to debate. He can do it anytime he wants.
The president, former president, spoke after his hush money trial wrapped up yesterday. CBS News Brief. I'm Stacey Lynn.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me, and I gladly stand up.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning. Well, you know, we find, of course, a lot of times our discussions with our clients and our prospects that we're meeting with is that they're one of their biggest concerns is how they're doing as far as keeping up with the pace of inflation. And, of course, we're finding that many of them are also aware of the indispensable role that dividends have played in the S&P 500 total return over time. Excuse me. In fact, dividends accounted for nearly 34% of the total return of the S&P 500 index from 1940 to 2023. That was 34% of the total. That said, we also are aware of the impact of inflation over time. And so today, let's talk a little bit about the extent of which dividend payments have outpaced inflation. The time frame that we're going to look at is the last 45-year period from 1979 until 2023. And basically what we find is that dividends per share paid by companies that comprise the index increased at a staggering pace when compared with the CPI or the cost of living increase. Over the 45-year period, the compound annual growth of dividends and paid by the companies that compared with the index stood at 5.78%. That's the compound rate of growth. For comparison, the compound annual growth rate of inflation, as measured by the CPIU, was just 3.13% over that same period. So dividends grew at 5.78%. Inflation grew at 3.13%. Dividends paid by the S&P 500 index companies reached a record of $588.23 billion in 2023. That represented a 4.2% year-over-year from $564.57 billion in 22, and it's up 28.9% from the $456.3 billion in 2018. Furthermore, the dividend payout ratio for the index stood at 36.77% on December 29th of 23. That's well below its 30-year average of 45.75%. So despite record-high dividend payments, companies that comprise the index are paying out a smaller portion of their total earnings in the form of dividends than average. From our perspective, companies are more likely to increase or keep dividend distributions steady if earnings are growing. So as of April 19th, Bloomberg forecasts that the index would see earnings growth of 8.81% and 13.64% in 24 and 25, respectively. So what's our takeaway from all this? Well, from 1975 to 2023, dividends per share paid by companies that comprise the S&P 500 index increased, at a compound annual growth rate of 5.78%. For comparison, the Consumer Price Index, or the All Urban Consumers, increased at a rate of 3.13% over that same period. So while the relationship between dividends and equity returns is generally well understood, we think the data presented reveals that dividends have provided a powerful offset to inflation pressures over time. So one of the things we can do is focus on making sure that we have dividend exposure to in a lot of our portfolios. Well, we're talking, hearing all the time about artificial intelligence. And as it continues to advance, we're finding investors are closely monitoring companies that facilitate this paradigm-shifting technology. While many focus on large-cap semiconductors and cloud service providers, we believe there may be other opportunities to position portfolios to potentially benefit from the growth in AI. Enterprises running AI programs need data centers equipped with high-performance computing clusters, which are servers interconnected by fast networks, enabling parallel processing that speeds up AI training and inference. Due to the surge in computing requirements for AI data, centers consume a vast amount of electricity for running servers and their cooling systems. The data centers that consume approximately 3% of total electricity in the United States today. However, given the intensifying demands from AI workloads, there are estimates now that data centers could potentially consume roughly 10% of total electricity in the U.S. by the end of the decade, posing significant challenges for electric grid operators. On top of that, they believe that increasing adoption of electric vehicles may also place additional strain on the power grid. So with the acceleration in demand growth, utility companies may need to significantly upgrade their grid and infrastructure to accommodate the rising electrical demands. Therefore, we believe that companies engaged in grid-related equipment and services, as well as those engaged in sustainable power generation, may be well-positioned to potentially benefit from the rising electricity demand from intensifying AI workloads. So just a little FYI. Well, I mentioned earlier that the this week we had the an economic goose out when the preferred core inflation gauge rose at a brisk rate in March. Well, the Federal Reserve's gauge of underlying U.S. inflation rose at a brisk pace in March, reinforcing concerns of persistent price increases that are likely to delay any interest rate cuts. The so-called core personal consumption expenditures price index, which strips out the volatile food and energy components, increased at 0.3% from the prior month, data out on Friday showed. A year ago, it advanced at 2.8%. The annual PCE price measure also rose 0.3% in February and 2.7% in the prior year. Inflation-adjusted consumer spending climbed at a larger than forecast 0.5%. That's the biggest gain this year. Faster inflation in the first quarter, combined with steady household spending, is going to likely persuade the Fed policymakers to refrain from lowering interest rates, if at all, until later this year. Officials meeting this next week are expected to hold borrowing costs at a two-decade high. Traders mostly reacted positively as investors took relief, and the monthly inflation report from quarterly figures on Thursday suggested upside risk in March. Central bankers pay close attention to services inflation, excluding housing and energy, which tends to be more sticky. That metric climbed 0.4% from February. That's an acceleration from the prior month, according to the BEA. A robust labor market is the main reason why households have yet to hit the brakes on spending in face of higher interest rates and elevated prices. Inflation-adjusted outlays for merchandise increased 1.1% last month. That's reflected a second straight month of solid spending on durable goods. Services spending, meanwhile, edged up at 0.2%. Demand for workers is still healthy, supporting wage growth. Overall incomes increased 0.5% as wages and salaries rose 0.7% for a second month, which is the strongest back-to-back gain since the start of the last year. The savings rate dropped to 3.2%. That's the lowest since October of 22. So looking ahead, central bankers are still hopeful that they can bring inflation down to their 2% target without breaking the economy. A separate report on Thursday showed the slower economic growth in the first quarter masked resilient household demand and business spending. So something we need to continue to keep an eye on. Well, got a little information this week I thought was rather interesting. And basically, this report says that Governor Inslee's latest wasteful electric vehicle subsidy is equivalent to paying $1,125 for a latte. Basically, he wants to buy 8,767 people a $1,125 latte, metaphorically at least. Governor Inslee's new program to subsidize the purchase of electric vehicles is so wasteful in reducing CO2 emissions. It is the equivalent of paying that absurd amount for a 16-ounce latte. On Earth Day, Governor Inslee announced a $45 million program to subsidize the purchase or lease of electric vehicles. The program is targeting for those making 300% of the federal poverty level or less, which amounts to $93,000 a year for a family of four. The program pays up to $9,000 for a lease of 3 years or more and $5,000 to purchase a two-year lease. The state estimates the subsidy could reduce up to 24,000 metric tons of CO2 over the life of the program. That estimates that about 8,767 people are going to receive rebates that each vehicle purchased would reduce 3.65 metric tons of CO2. What does that mean to the planet? Virtually nothing. Even worse, it is a massive waste of money that could go to projects that do yield environmental benefits. Using the state's own estimates, the program pays $1,875 to reduce each metric ton of CO2. By way of comparison, the state's CO2 price is only $25.76, or just over 1% of the amount paid by the subsidy. It's even worse than that, though. Although anyone can invest in projects that reduce CO2 emissions by the $10 per metric ton, at that rate, the state's new EV subsidy spends about 187 times as much as publicly available alternatives to cut CO2 emissions. That is, they are like paying $1,125 for that $6 latte. The press release says the program is important because transportation is the biggest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. Even if the program is successful, the yields and maximum CO2 reductions that we predict would reduce total state transportation-related CO2 emissions by about 0.03%. It spends $45 million to reduce transportation-related CO2 emissions by about 0.03%. By way of comparison, the same amount the state could have doubled the two-year budget for salmon recovery projects funded by the Washington State Salmon Recovery Funding Board. But it gets worse than that. Washington State already has a cap on CO2 emissions, so any reductions in one area means the state can emit more elsewhere up to the cap. In effect, this program does nothing to reduce CO2 emissions because the tiny amount of reduction will be made up elsewhere, as allowed for under the state's CO2 law. This is one more example of how wasteful and ineffective Washington's climate policy is. It also reveals the disingenuousness of claiming that climate change is an essential crisis, wasting tens of millions of dollars on projects that do nothing to address the crisis. As long as the media coverage is uncritical and special interest groups continue to praise government waste, we can expect Washington's elected officials to continue to prioritize politics over the planet. Just an FYI. Dick Donahue with you with the Wealth Wake Up Live. We'll be back.
By texting 64,000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Babbel. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at babbel.com/TNC.
I want to learn how to cook, but I keep ordering takeout.
Accomplishing goals is hard, but when your goal is to learn a new language, Babbel makes it easy. In just 15 minutes a day, Babbel will help you start having conversations in as little as 3 weeks. So when someone asks,
how's your French going?
You can say,
Babbel facilite grandement l'apprentissage d'une nouvelle langue.
Now try Babbel free. Just text radio to 64,000. Text radio to 64,000.
Find what you love. Love what you find. A Total Wine and More. There's so much waiting for you. Spirits and beer. Thousands of wines. Walk right through the door. It's all here to explore. With guides in the know. And prices so low. It just might blow your mind. You're gonna find what you love. And love what you find.
Drink responsibly. B21.
KGMI wants to put a grand in your hand. You could be one word away from a chance to win $1,000.
That's right. Just listen each weekday to KGMI for the keyword during the 8 a.m., 11 a.m., 2 p.m., and 5 p.m. hours.
Then go to the Grand in Your Hand contest page at mybellinghamnow.com before midnight and enter each keyword for your chance to win $1,000.
We'll have four keywords each weekday so you can increase your chances of winning by entering all four every day we play the contest.
You already listen to KGMI for the latest local news and discussion of the latest issues. Now you can win $1,000 while you do it.
A Grand in Your Hand is brought to you on KGMI by Niederhaus of Luxury, Whatcom County's newest fine jewelry store, next to Lombardi's on Bellwether Way.
A Grand in Your Hand is back on KGMI.
Get details at mybellinghamnow.com.
'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning here on KGMI. As always, we thank you for being with us. If you've got questions for us, always give us a call, 360-733-1200. Well, we saw a report also said that basically that voters are seeing a retirement crisis looming, according to a new survey. Basically, the nation's registered voters appear to be confirming what economists and advisors have been warning about for years. They see a national retirement crisis on the horizon. That was the conclusion of 833 registered voters by the Alliance for Prosperity and a Secure Retirement. That's a nonprofit that contracted Public Opinion Strategies to carry out the study in February. The survey found that 80% of voters feel that Americans are not prepared for retirement, and that 87% feel that the country will be facing a retirement crisis. Only 26% of voters said that they are extremely or very confident that they have enough money for their own retirements, the group said in a press release. Another 31% said that they're somewhat confident. And younger voters were less confident about their retirement security, and so were voters without pensions. Just 16% of Gen Z voters, 23% of millennials, 22% of Gen Xers, and 36% of retirees said that they are extremely or very confident about having enough money for retirement. The focus groups conducted in Columbus, Ohio, and Atlanta, the group also found that voters were nearly unanimously opposed to state elected officials directing pension fund investment decisions. So, kind of interesting little comments there. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about some of the essential retirement plan guides, things that you may be wanting to look at if you're going to take withdrawals from your retirement plans in 2024. And we find that many people spend most of their working lives setting money aside in employer-sponsored 401k and traditional IRA retirement accounts. Their goal is to eventually use those savings to enjoy their golden years, and the IRS even provides them with a tax deduction to do so. The tax code provides deductions for contributing to pre-tax retirement accounts. In return, savers commit to paying taxes on those contributions and investment earnings in the future. For a significant portion of time, retirement account owners have the flexibility on when they're going to take those distributions and therefore when they're going to pay those taxes. However, once they reach that required beginning date, the IRS states starts to impose taxes through mandatory withdrawals called required minimum distributions, or what we call RMDs. So here's what you need to know about the RMD rules. First of all, what is your RMD age? Well, it's changed over a period of time. And before the passage of the Secure Act at the end of 2019, RMDs for IRAs and 401k holders were required starting at age 70 and a half. The Secure Act pushed the RMD age back to 72. In 2022, we passed Secure Act 2, which pushed the age for account holder that must start their RMDs to 73. So creating a lot of confusion. But in addition to that, we have one more change coming. And if you're born after 1960, the Secure Act 2.0 pushed your RMD age back to 75. So that means that if you're born 60 or later, you don't have to start taking your RMDs out until you're 75. And the deadline to take your RMDs each year is December 31st. But the IRS does give a first-year exception, allowing account holder to delay the first RMD until April 1st of the year following the year which they reach that required age. So for account holders who turned 73 last year, they had until April 1st of this year to do it. If you turn 73 this year, you have until April 1st of next year to take out that first RMD. So let's talk a little bit about how RMDs are calculated. The IRS bases its RMD calculation on the account holder's age and the value of their pre-tax assets. Basically, the formula is as follows. You take the sum of all of your pre-tax assets. that would be valued as of December 31st of the prior year, and you divide that by your RMD or distribution period. The IRS publishes a table called the Uniform Life Table, which illustrates an account holder's RMD factor based on their age. For example, an 80-year-old would have to divide the sum of all their pre-tax assets by 20.2. That means that they would take out almost 5% of their account value. As an account holder gets older, the IRS is eager to reclaim that tax benefit that was offered, so it reduces the RMD factor each year. This accelerates the account holder's required distributions. Starts out at age 73 at about 3.7% and continues to increase, as I said, for example, so by age 80 it's up to 5%. So what happens if you miss taking one of those RMDs? Well, the IRS is not friendly to account holders who incorrectly calculate or fail to take their RMD in the required year. Starting this in 2023, the IRS assesses a 25% penalty on any undistributed RMD amounts. Prior to 2023, the penalty was 50% on those amounts. Account holders can apply for an RMD penalty relief. There's a form called the IRS Form 5329 and attach a letter with an explanation and support that shows that the missed RMD amount will be distributed as soon as reasonably possible. It is important to note, account holders can satisfy their entire RMD from one single account if they have multiple IRAs. So if you have several IRAs, you're allowed to take the money out of one of them rather than all of them. However, if you have an employer plan where you still have money sitting in there like a 401k or a simple or a 403b, there the counts cannot be aggregated. And there you must take a distribution from each individual employer plan. That's one of the biggest reasons that we see a lot of people consolidate their plans and roll them over into an IRA, just to avoid that confusion and potential problems if they don't take money out of all of them. The IRS allows account holders to delay their first RMD until the year following their 73rd birthday. However, for many account holders, delaying that first RMD could lead to unnecessary complications during tax season. It's important to understand that the U.S. income tax brackets are marginal. In the simplest terms, this means that you pay higher income corresponds to higher tax rates. So what I'm talking about here is, when should you take that first RMD? Should an account holder choose to postpone that first RMD, which they can do that first year, then they're going to be required to take two RMDs the following year. As I said, they would have to be done by the end of March of that following year. The first RMD is required by April 1st, as I said, or end of March. The second would also be by December 31st of that same year. So as a result, this is going to increase an account holder's taxable income, possibly the marginal tax rate. In addition, the December 31st RMD is going to be calculated based on the prior year's account balance. So the first year, you would take your December 31st balance, you would calculate your RMD. If you delayed that money until the following year, which you could do the first year around, you don't change that calculation. But now that money is still in the account. So when you calculate the RMD for the following year, that account balance is going to be higher. Therefore, that second RMD is going to be higher also. So delaying that first RMD places most account holders at risk of facing higher taxes, also possibly increased Medicare premiums, and all the drawbacks associated with higher income. So should you start your IRA and retirement withdrawals before your RMD age? Well, once an account holder reaches their milestone of 59 and a half, they are permitted to withdraw funds from their traditional IRAs and their retirement plan accounts penalty-free. Before 59 and a half, you face that 10% early withdrawal penalty in addition to federal and state, if applicable, income taxes. Between the ages of 59 and a half and 73, account holders have the flexibility to choose whether or not to withdraw funds from these accounts, as the IRS does not mandate a minimum distribution during that period. So you don't have to start taking it until that year that you turn 73. Make that clear. So while there's no requirement to withdraw funds from pre-tax accounts between 59.5 and 73, account holders should consider the option of doing so. Since the U.S. income tax brackets are marginal, spreading out distributions over an extended time frame reduces the chance of jumping into a higher tax bracket later. If an account holder anticipates their income is going to be higher, relatively steady through retirement, it's also tax savvy to withdraw from these accounts sooner than 73. This allows account holders to spread out their taxable income over multiple periods and avoid a possible RMD tax bomb going off at age 73. There are some situations that may arise where account holders may want to pass and take in the withdrawals. These include situations of large liquidity event in a single year, qualifying health tax queries, and also worrying about income-related Medicare adjustments or IRMAs. Also, the other part of this discussion, we're going to run out of time, is Roth conversions. You may want to do Roth conversions during a period of time when you're between that 59.5 and 73, only because your income is lower and you're not required to take out distributions during that period of time. So basically, something we do a lot of, something we made a lot with our clients. Got questions for us, you give us a call, 360-733-1200. And don't forget our show tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Again, our phone number, 360-733-1200. Thank you.
Voiced on the show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision.